Good to be with you this morning. Good to see each and every one of you here. We've got some visitors in our crowd and some familiar faces of visitors. Encouraging to have you here today. last week, we began a discussion on the armor of God. And we never looked at the armor at all last week. We only talked about the context that surrounded that armor. And so this week we're going to move a little bit further into the text of Ephesians chapter 6, and we'll talk a little bit more about this armor. And what is so significant about this armor is this isn't anything that God has just handed down to us, but this is armor that has been tried, tested, and proved. This armor has been worn before. We are not the first to put on the armor of God that we find in Ephesians chapter 6, but rather the first to wear it was God Himself. It was Christ. We identified that when we looked in the prophecies of Isaiah, and this is exactly what Paul is referencing. He's not bringing up any kind of new ideas here in Ephesians 6, but rather he is calling back to mind what we read about in Isaiah 11 and Isaiah 52, and especially Isaiah chapter 59, where God is looking down upon mankind, and He sees the great mess that we are in, and He is sorrowful that there is none that can bring us out of this mess of sin. There is none righteous, no, not one. All have fallen. All have fallen short of the glory of God. And so we see God in that image from heaven, putting on the armor. This is Christ putting on His armor and coming down and winning the battle for us, defeating that which we couldn't defeat on our own, taking care of sin, defeating Satan, defeating death, coming out 3 days later from the grave victorious. And so, as we see here in Ephesians 6, he is using these same terminology as what was originally stated back in Isaiah chapter 59, when he tells us now, as we learned back in chapter 5, he told us to imitate Christ, and now in chapter 6, he tells us to put on that armor. In verse 10, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Now, let's not sit here and read this as if we're reading a novel, as we're just reading a literature or just some simple document. But let's understand what we're reading. Let's see here as he began with this idea of putting on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. This text is dealing with our life. Dealing with whether we will live or die, and what is necessary to keep us living, to keep us alive, and what's necessary for us to win the victory. And so this is something that should bring our minds to some very sobering thoughts. This is a very serious text. It is a very heavy text. And we should pay it a great deal of reverence when we're taking a look at it. Let's remember again when he's telling us, put on this armor, this whole armor of God. What does he have in his hands? What is he handing down? This is the same armor that Christ used to win the battle over death. And now it's being handed down to us. Here, put this on. And what a striking image that is of Christ having won the battle, having taken off that armor in his ascension into heaven. He takes off that armor, but now he holds it in his hands. He walks up to us. Here, put this on. Now, if we think of it as literally as that, I think we can't help but to see what a sober moment that is for us. When everything that's being called into our minds as we're looking there at that armor that's being handed to us. And as we take it into our hands and we see the dried blood of the Savior on the medal. And to think that this is what we now need to put on. The armor of Christ, the armor that He used to win, and the armor that the same armor we'll use to win. And how awesome a thought is it that we do not serve a God who is far away and has never done anything of Himself, but rather we serve a God who has been in the action. He has fought against the devil. He has destroyed the works of the devil in the first century on the cross. And in rising 3 days later, O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? And that's the kind of God that we serve, who has been on that battlefield. And now He is essentially saying, follow Me. Follow My steps of truth and righteousness. That's what this armor is made up of. And so we notice that it's not our armor. It belongs to someone else. And it belongs to someone far stronger than who we are. But there in verse 10, if you see how Paul began the discussion, he said, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. It's not of us. This is not our armor. And that truth doesn't belong to us. It belongs to Christ. That righteousness doesn't belong to us. It belongs to Christ. Put on the armor of God, he says, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Now, let's focus a little bit on this word, or rather two words in the English, whole armor. Put on the whole armor. Now, in English, that's two words, but in the Greek, it's one word. It's translated into two English words, but in the Greek, there's one word to describe this idea, and it's panoplia. And that might strike some of you, especially those who've long sung some of the songs of the church. There's a song we sing. It might be in several songs. I know one comes to mind, Soldiers of Christ Arise. There's a song that we sing, Soldiers of Christ Arise, and it speaks of the panoply of God in the song. The panoply of God. That's what we're dealing with here. The panoply of God is the full and complete whole armor of God. Described in one word, panoply. Now, what I find fascinating about this word is its use in the New Testament Greek. It's used only here in one other place. Now we see how it's used here. The panoply of God. The whole armor of God. But there's one other place in the New Testament that this word is used. Jesus uses it when He was in the flesh. And He speaks of it in reference to the panoply of Satan. So in all the New Testament, we have the panoply of God here in Ephesians 6. And in the other place in which this word is used, it's used in reference to the panoply of Satan. I want us to take a look at that text. It's back in Luke chapter 11. Luke chapter 11, beginning in verse 17. Now this is where Jesus had cast out a demon and had been casting out demons. And we have the people around Him, they're just marveling at the power of Christ. And there are some, however, that have some vile intentions. And they're not marveling at this, but rather they're coming up with some sort of excuse. They're trying to build some sort of argument against the Lord. And so they come up with this idea, they start to spread this thought that, oh, Jesus is just doing this by the power of the devil. He's casting out demons by the power of Beelzebub. Well, in verse 17, it says, but He, that's Jesus, knowing their thoughts, said to them, Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and a house divided against a house falls. If Satan also is divided against himself, how will this his kingdom stand? Because you say, I cast out demons by Beelzebub. And if I cast out demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore, they will be your judges. But if I cast out demons by the finger of God, surely the kingdom of God has come upon you. When a strong man, fully armed, guards his own palace, his goods are in peace. But when a stronger than he comes upon him and overcomes him, he takes from him all his armor in which he trusted and divides his spoils. He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. So, these folks that are saying, well, Jesus is just doing this by the power of the demons and the devil. Well, he quickly destroys that argument and this idea of a house divided itself against itself cannot stand. And why in the world would the devil try to cast out evil? He says, but if I cast out these demons by the finger of God, then surely the kingdom of God has come upon you. The powers of God has come upon you. And so as he continues on here, beginning in verse 21, he starts to paint this illustration of a strong man having his armor on. And he says that he's at peace. He's at peace in his house because there's no one else around that is stronger than he is. And he's got his protection on and everything like that. And so he's going to be okay. But, he says in verse 22, what happens now when a stronger than he comes? When a stronger than the strong man comes, what happens? Well, the stronger one overcomes him, he says, and takes from him all his armor in which he trusted and divides his spoils. So the stronger one comes in the illustration, what does he do? Overcomes the fight. There's a battle. And he overcomes because he's stronger. And then what does he do? He takes that armor away from this one who's the weaker. The armor is taken away. But the Greek word used here is the word panoplia, the full armor. Now, Jesus is using it here in reference to the full armor of Satan in verse 22. And he is speaking of himself, certainly in the text, as the stronger one. Because who's being cast out here? Who's being cast away? Is it Jesus or is it the demons? So Jesus is showing his power and casting out the demons. And that is a display there in the first century. That was a display of who is stronger than who. As you see Jesus casting out the demons, he is demonstrating that he is stronger than the devil. And this illustration here is of him being the stronger one who is to come. And he has come to overtake the weaker one, who was first considered the strong man in the previous verse, which is the devil. And he says that he will overcome him and he will take away all his armor, take away his panoply, his full set of arms. So in the two places in which this Greek word is used, it is first used in Luke 11, speaking of the armor of the devil, in which Christ is overcome and has stripped that armor away from him. And then it's used in Ephesians 6, the central point of our study, the armor of God, the panoply of God. Put on the armor of Christ. Now, how interesting is it that we are putting on the arms of Christ when he has already demonstrated in the biblical record that he has overcome Satan with this armor? He has overcome Satan with this strength, and he's even stripped the strength of Satan. He has stripped him of all his armor, his whole panoply. He is stripped. And so we are left with a bare Satan. We are left now with the armor of Christ. The scriptures are certainly not silent about the idea that one stronger than the devil would come and would be the victor. In fact, in the very beginnings of the Bible, the first prophecy of Christ talks about these ideas. In Genesis chapter 3, just after the first sin, God almost immediately gives a word of prophecy about victory. On a day of terrible defeat, God speaks of victory. Genesis 3:15, God said to the serpent there in the garden, He said to the serpent, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. That's a puzzling notion, isn't it? The seed of a woman? That's impossible. All man comes from the seed of man, right? There's no such thing as the seed of a woman. But notice as he continues on, he says, he, giving an identification to the seed of the woman. It is a male. It is one individual. He shall bruise your head, the head of the serpent, he says, and you shall bruise his heel. So we have an identification given to this seed of the woman. Now, all men come from the seed of man, except we know that there has been one to come from the seed of woman. There has been one not to come from man. And that's Jesus Christ, the righteous. So, we have this individual. He says, he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. That's the stated prophecy. I'm not sure if the English word bruise is the absolute best rendering of the original Hebrew. But if you look at the original Hebrew word there in your lexicons and your dictionaries, you'll find that it is a word playing off of the concepts of the serpent. Because the word literally means to open your mouth wide and to snap down. All right, so we see how that would make a whole lot of sense in the context of God speaking to the devil as the serpent. He's going to open that mouth wide and he's going to snap down. All right, and so the word can mean to bruise, it can mean to crush, all kinds of things like that, whatever that snap down would cause, the cause and effect. So we have here, he says, you will bruise his heel. Okay, you're the serpent, and notice the striking range of the serpent. It's not too much higher than the heel, is it? All right, they're way down there on the ground. All right, their nose is in the dust of the earth. And so that's kind of the striking range of a snake, right? And so this word is talking about the snake opening that mouth wide, trying to get all that he can, trying to cause the greatest amount of damage. But what is the damage? All right, a bump on the heel. He comes down on that heel. That causes a problem. But there's a much bigger problem afoot. Because speaking of the seed of the woman, he says, will bruise your head. Now, same word that is used there. And so you have the snake lashing at the heel of this man, and you have the man looking down in the picture, in the illustration, man looking down, raising up his foot, and smash on the head. So one receives a blow to the heel, the other receives a blow to the head. And so from the very beginning of the Bible, God has spoken to Satan in this way, that one would be stronger than he, that one would overcome him and overwhelm him. The New Testament also is not silent about these ideas. 1 John chapter 3, for example, and verse 8, where John speaks to the Christians and says, he who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. And for this purpose, the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. That he might strip the panoply of the devil. All right? He had the strength in his armor. If you remember back there in Luke 11, Jesus talked about the panoply of the devil. It says, in which he trusted, Jesus said. He trusted in that strength. But that's all that he had. So what happens when someone stronger comes along? Defeat. For this purpose, he said, John said, the Son of God was manifested. Came to the earth. Came and revealed himself among men. That he might destroy the works of the devil. It's exactly the illustration that Jesus was talking about in Luke 11. About the panoply of the devil. And a stronger than he who would come. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 15. Speaking of Christ having disarmed principalities and powers. It says he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it. You see the strength of Christ. The strength of his armor. The same armor that he has now handed bloodstains and all down to us. Saying, put on the whole armor of God. Put on the panoply of Christ. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14, he said, inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood. What does he mean by that? He just means being a human. We're flesh and blood. He says, he himself, in the context speaking of Christ, likewise shared in the same. That is, he also took on the form of a human. He took on flesh and blood. It says that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death. That is, the devil. And so we see what the biblical record has to say on these things. A stronger than he had come. The serpent had struck at the heel of the Lord. But the Lord simply raised up the strength of his armor. He raised up his foot and he came and crushed the head of the snake. There's certainly a great difference there in the strength of the two of these individuals. But so if we look back here at Ephesians 6 now, having come full circle back, because we've went off on a purposeful tangent talking about this panoply, this Greek word panoplia, the whole armor. We're now told in verse 10 to be strong in the Lord. Not our strength, it's his strength. We learn from Isaiah 59, we couldn't do it. We were in a whole heap of a mess. We were in sin, we were enslaved to sin, we were in bondage, and we didn't have the key. Remember back in the book of Revelation, we see that image of Jesus after he ascended. He had the keys of death and of Hades. That's the strength of Christ. That's the strength of what he did. That's the strength of the armor that he used to defeat Satan. And now he is handing us down this armor. It is his strength. It is his power. Be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. Put on the panoply of God, the whole armor of God, he says, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. He explains in verse 12, saying, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Now that verse 12, that's quite a verse, isn't it? Now we might look at that as a terrifying verse. Look at what we're up against. Principalities and powers in the heavenly places, these spiritual hosts of darkness. That is a terrifying thought. Well, we haven't observed the context too well, have we? If that's the kind of conclusion we're going to come to, we've missed the whole point of the text. The point of the text is not to scare us. It is to let us know what we're up against. But the point of the text is to show us the victory in Christ. Put on the whole armor of God so that we can defeat Satan, so that we can defeat sin, so that we can defeat death, so that we will be victorious. It's not a text telling us that we might be defeated. It's a text letting us know we're going to be victorious as long as we do what we need to do in taking on the armor of Christ. So we shouldn't be concerned about verse 12. It should not strike fear in our minds, not when we look down at ourselves and see, wait a second here, I've got the armor of Christ. I know what Christ did with these kinds of things. I know the kind of strength and power that he had. Now, in verse 11, he had talked about these wiles of the devil. And we might have a question about that. What is that, the wiles of the devil? Well, the Greek word there is a word you might kind of recognize it because it looks like the English word method. And that's pretty much what it means. It has a different, kind of goes down a little bit of a different path than that. But it is the idea of a method of travel and adventure is how the word would be used in secular Greek. But you see it also being used in the idea of one having a method of deceit and trickery and wanting to, their way of traveling is actually to wait patiently and to lie in wait. And so this is used in reference to the devil, the methods, the wicked methods of Satan. And so this text definitely tells us that Satan has a method, he has a plan, you know, he plots and he does wait patiently sometimes, so we may not always see him around, but he's around and he's waiting patiently for the right time to strike. All right, but he strikes at the heel. And if we're wearing that armor of Christ, notice where we're at again. Notice where we're at. Be strong in the Lord and the power of his might. So we shouldn't have anything to fear from the wiles of the devil because we're fully armed. We're fully prepared. We're fully ready. And we have the kind of power of Christ to be able to win each and every time. But still, it might be in some of us this thought in our hearts, the wiles of the devil. I'm concerned about that. I'm not exactly sure what this is. I want us to look back a little bit earlier in Ephesians. In chapter 2, he said in verse 1 to the church at Ephesus, chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, "And you he made alive." That is you, the brethren at Ephesus. "Christ made alive, who once were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others." And so, if you read a text like that, this is a text that tells us where we once were before we came into Christ. And we wonder, what are the wiles of the devil? What are the methods and the ways and the paths of the devil? Have we forgotten? Think about that. If we wonder what these things are, then we must have forgotten where we've been before. We must have forgot that we were once in the camp of the devil. That we were once in the camp of death and of sin. He talked about how we once all conducted ourselves in the lust of the flesh. You know, we walked according to that course of the world. Have we forgotten where we've come? We should know all too well the methods of Satan. These were the same methods that we followed after day in and day out in our lives before we came to Christ. And some of us maybe in this room have yet to walk away from those methods. The Bible tells us about the ways of the world. 1 John 2, verse 15, we know all about the world. We're well acquainted with it. We've lived a time and a period within it. There in 1 John 2, verse 15, he says, do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. The world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. We know what Satan has in his capacity. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Let's not think that his devices are unknown to us. In every way, really, we have a benefit in once being a part of his camp and now being a part of the camp of Christ and putting on the armor of Christ. We have every benefit to us to succeed. We've spied out the other side. We lived like them. We acted like them. We know everything about that side. The wiles of the devil should not be a fear to us. They should be something that we are well acquainted with. And so when he says, put on that armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil, he is not talking about things that we're not familiar with, but he is certainly talking about things that we can fall to, that we can struggle with. Even though we're now in the camp of Christ, we will always have struggles with sin and temptation. And that's the idea of this text, is making sure we have put on the panoply of Christ. I tell you, what a thought. Just thinking of that literally, and I know it's not literal, but thinking of that from more of a picture standpoint, an illustration of our life, having that armor on, feeling its weight, feeling it, knowing that this is the power of Christ. It is sobering. It calls us to revere the Lord, causes us to understand this life a little bit better and the battles that we face and what we need to do day in and day out. It is an honor to wear the things of Christ. It is an armor to carry about with us the instruments of the Lord. And what a shame is it? Every time we make that decision, that ridiculous decision, to shed that armor and to go about parading in the ways of death. There's a lot more for us to consider in that text. And I'd like to go deeper with you, if the Lord wills, here in the near future, about some of these things that we have at our disposal, that we can always use, and we should never put down. But we're out of time, certainly, this morning. So if there is anyone here who has yet to take upon them the things of Christ, if you're a Christian, you've been struggling, you've been suffering, and you need help putting that armor back on. You need help understanding what you need to do in your life. And we certainly want to help you get to heaven. So just let us know.